This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A rock is a rock is a rock, right? Well, maybe. Geologists and geochemists who study the rock that makes up our planet have found that the solid rock under our feet may not be as solid as we think.
Well, it's actually a complex field that have been studied for a long time, and we're still learning about it.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series continues with a look at the constant shift of the structure of the Earth and how that may have clues to the origins of life on the planet. We'll also spend an academic minute studying life on the Bering Strait, you know, before it became a strait. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Martin Guitrou is a rock star. When we think about the rocks that compose planet Earth, two words come to mind, solid and stationary. Those two adjectives, however, would be an inaccurate way to describe the continuing process of rock formation that has created our planet. That's where Dr. Martin Guitrou comes in. He's a postdoctoral research teaching associate at the University of New Hampshire, and he recently spoke to the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gastina about the concepts of geochemistry as well as igneous and metamorphic petrology as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life.
So geochemistry is the application of chemistry to the understanding of how rocks form. So we use chemistry, and that helps us understand what's going on in terms of geological processes that the rock underwent.
When you're looking at rocks and wind, of course, there's going to be some things that are going to happen as a result of that.
Yeah. So in terms of igneous and metamorphic petrology, is using more physical processes and physical concepts to understand how rocks form, because the rocks are formed of tiny minerals, and we understand how minerals form. So igneous is basically for rocks that crystallize from a magma or a lava. So that's basically understanding all these processes.
Well, we don't know how these processes work. How do you form a mineral?
There are many ways of forming a mineral that can involve inorganic chemistry or organic chemistry, like organisms. So in the sea, sometimes you have organisms that develop their own shells, and that's crystallizing minerals like calcite or aragonite. And you can also crystallize minerals from high temperature fluids or also from magmas, basically.
And what do you learn? What are you learning by seeing this crystallization? What do we learn about the Earth and that process?
Well, on a different basis, you can learn many things. Like, for instance, the evolution of magma chambers that will trigger eruptions. Or you can learn a lot about the evolution of the Earth, looking at rocks formed, the same kind of rocks formed at different times during the Earth evolution.
So, for example, you say one of your research interests, if we were to look at what we were just talking about, they can be summarized in more simplified terms by saying, one, you look at the formation and the evolution of the continental crust. What's the continental crust?
That's a good question. So continental crust is usually made of granites. So it's an assemblage of quartz, feldspars, and ferromagnesian minerals. So it means silicate minerals, and ferromagnesian contains iron and magnesium, as their name indicates. So basically, they're formed from granites.
Yeah, but the crust indicates that there's something under it, right? It's the crust. So how deep is the continental crust?
The average depth is about 30 kilometers, and sometimes you have like particular geological processes that create mountains like the Himalayas, the Alps, and in these settings, the crust could be as thick as 60 up to 70 kilometers.
We would say that's very deep.
It is.
Beneath the Earth. And of course, you don't just have the crust, but then you have the mantle, right? So now this leads to the second area, the composition, structure, and evolution of the mantle. Can you give us some sense of how that did evolve?
Well, it's actually a complex field that have been studied for a long time, and we're still learning about it. But the mantle is assumed to have formed from a primordial composition and then evolved and developed at least two domains. It depends if you look at the physical side of it or the chemical side of it, because you can sometimes have different answers depending on how you study the mantle. And usually the mantle that is accessible to us through xenolith, so enclaves, so small pieces of mantle that is brought to the surface by magmas, you just have access to a tiny window, and that's not the whole mantle, and some part of it is kind of inaccessible, directly at least.
Thus the complexity of it all, trying to fit in those missing pieces of that puzzle in what you're not able to see.
Yeah.
So there's this word reservoir that comes into play. Explain that.
So when you study the Earth as a whole, it's usually hard to figure out, because of geological complexities of rocks and all that, it's hard to conceptualize it in a simple way. So that's why the term reservoir comes into play, especially when you use chemistry. And that's what we do as first-order models. You want to understand what one reservoir that could be the mantle and its influence on the crust and, you know, back-and-forth effect that one can have on the other one. And so that's a way of simplifying Earth to like get a first order answers, and then from that we can go further and get into more complex models.
One of the things I think we might want to stop and just acknowledge here is the idea that a sort of layperson, the person who's not a scientist and thinks about the Earth, we often think of it as a solid piece of rock. Yes, there's oceans, but the Earth doesn't move. Oh, yes, it does, right?
Yeah, it does.
Constantly.
Yeah, and in many ways, and depending on, say, reservoir we consider, if it's the crust or the mantle, the kind of motion you will find is kind of different. And also, if you go back in time, the motion might have been also different.
How so? What do you mean it's different? Explain.
So at the surface, there is what we call the horizontal tectonics, which is what we refer to as plate tectonics. To simplify that, it's like you have a ship pretty much floating on a sea of mantle rocks, and there is motion of the oceanic crust, which is melt generated at mid-ocean ridges, so under the sea, and then that spreads apart and then gets sink back into mantle, and the crust is formed usually in these kind of settings. And in the mantle, it's more complex, and we don't have really observations to fit our model with, but it's usually stirring more like what you would have when you cook pastas, for instance. You see motions in the water. So that's, you know, a simplified model, but basically something that's closest to the truth. And I was referring to different motions in the past, because we assumed that the Earth was hotter and the crust as well was hotter. And so the rheology of the crust was different. So instead of having just horizontal tectonics, so like strong continents, strong pieces of rocks moving, you also had some vertical tectonics that we call subduction. So we had denser piles of volcanic rocks deposited on top of the crust, and that one sunk into the crust.
So there's not only a sort of horizontal movement, but a vertical movement as well. And of course, we know about plate tectonics, most notably when we speak of earthquakes.
Exactly, because earthquakes are generated in subduction zones, where the oceanic crust dives into the mantle under continents because of density contrast. And that friction between the subducting slab and the mantle creates those earthquakes.
Not only earthquakes, but as it continues to move, you might see some lava flows come right up and out and create volcanoes and mountainous regions, yes?
Exactly. So the process itself is really interesting, because the rocks there, I mean, the mantle rocks shouldn't melt because they're most of the time in equilibrium. But the water brought by this subducting slab, actually, so when it dives into the mantle, it dehydrates, and that water percolates through the mantle, and it lowers its melting temperature, and that's how you generate the volcanism at subduction zones.
All leading to the Earth in constant flux, and this great Earth machine that, through all these processes, creating the continents we live on, not only that, but things happening under the ocean floor, of course, which could push right up and through and create a new land mass. We really have advanced, as far as what I can tell, pretty far in terms of our understandings now of how our Earth looks now with the different continents, what it looked like in the past, and where it's going.
Yeah, we went quite far, actually, yeah, in the knowledge. But there are still a lot of debates going on, and some of them particularly involved the evolution of the volume of the continental crust, because there are extreme models assuming that the crust that we see today, at least the distribution of ages, is similar to, you know, what actually happened. So the crust was built progressively. Another model involved very early extraction of continents, And the rest was just either reworking the crust, so because you have activity, you generate new rocks. But is it, you know, extracting magmas from the mantle or just remelting the crust that was already extracted?
Kind of like the moisture on the earth. All the water on the earth is recycled. Is this basically what you're talking about with the earth structure? Is it creating new or is it just recycling and recycling and recycling?
Yeah. And there is some alternative to the recycling because some people have assumed that there is a kind of steady state because crust can be recycled into the mantle, but the amount of recycling possibly achievable is still a question. So people assume that at some point you can put some of the crust back into the mantle and extract some new magma. So you would keep the same volume just by steady state between extraction and recycling.
Still to come, David Gustina's conversation with Dr. Gitru continues with a look at different types of geology that, frankly, we've never heard of. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1240. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Martin Gitru, a postdoctoral research teaching associate at the University of New Hampshire. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina about his work in geology and geochemistry as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life.
Just to remind folks, we're talking to Dr. Martin Gitru, and he is a postdoctoral research teaching associate working at the University of New Hampshire, and his research interests include geochemistry, igneous, and metamorphic petrology, which we've been talking about. And we can keep it simple and say that the evolution of the Earth, the Earth's crusts, these various levels and processes that are involved therein. And I also see here, as part of your research interests and the summary of those, Dr. Gitru, that it says Archean, yep, and Hadean geology. What's that?
So the Hadean and the Archean are really old period of the Earth, what we call eons. So the Archean goes from 2.5 billion years ago to 4 billion, and the Hadean goes from 4 billion up to the formation of the Earth. So the rock that we found in that period, even though there is no rock from the Hadean, we just have remnants through detrital minerals extracted from sediments. But the Archean is a really interesting period because we find rock types that we no longer find today that testify to processes that were kind of different, or parameters associated with these events were.
So give us an example.
So a really typical example is these rocks called komatiites, which are really interesting rocks, very, very nice. So these are just lavas. But the amount of melting that the mantle underwent was really high. Part of that explains the composition of these rocks, because in the present day Earth, the Earth is cooler than it used to be, and so you don't have such amount of melting, and so you just generate basalts instead of generating these high degree of melting rocks.
Oh, it's fascinating. So we know too, right, Dr. Gitru, that the Earth didn't only heat up and melt once, but it has gone through several evolutions of this heating up and cooling down and heating up and cooling down, yes?
Well, it depends on what you refer to. Maybe you refer to as the magma ocean, because usually at the formation of the Earth, it is assumed that you had a lot of radioactive elements that had short life. So all these ones decayed very rapidly, and because the heat couldn't be extracted, the Earth started to melt. But the question is, did it melt entirely, or did it melt just as small portions of the mantle? So it's, I guess in the present day, it's not debated that it melted. The question is, how much did it melt?
So as part of your work, are you trying to answer that question?
Not directly, but I work with colleagues that use systems that help understanding these questions.
I imagine one of those is analytical geochemistry.
Yeah. So the way it works, as I said, there were some short-lived elements that gives you some insights into the processes that happened during that time. And some of them that are called the samarium-neodymium system And I have colleagues working on that. And so that's true chemistry. We use those systems to try to figure out what's going on during these times.
So chemistry, geochemistry, geology, multidisciplines. And it seems like more and more scientists are taking a multidisciplinary approach because we know that none of these separate disciplines exist separately in the world.
Yeah, that's totally right. And we, as geologists, we used to say that the Earth is a nice laboratory to experiment the theoretical concepts that have been developed in physics and chemistry. And yeah, that's a really, you know, multidisciplinary domain because we want to get as many parameters in our interpretation as possible to get the closest interpretation or the most accurate.
As you said, it's so complex because you have so many different variables that are happening and you are not in those areas, the Archean, you're not in the Hadean. You have to make some educated guesses, yes?
Yeah, that's right. And usually we use these chemical tools or we study these rocks that are evidence of what was going on at that time. And from their analysis and most of the time comparison with present-day processes, we can get you know, very important insights into what was going on during these periods.
Tell me what the LUHF isotope system is.
Oh, so that's what we call an isotope radiogenic system. So where you have a lutetium that is a radioactive, I mean, it's a chemical element, and there is an isotope that is radioactive, like, you know, uranium can be radioactive. So it means that's a chemical element that is unstable and will decay into hafnium. And that decay, we can follow that decay through time. And so the way we use it could be as a chronometer, because lutetium, I mean, we know how it decays.
Explain what that is, a chronometer, for people.
Okay, so that's a way of measuring time, basically. So lutetium will decay into hafnium with a certain rate that we know of. So we basically analyze those systems in a rock, and it's basically counting how much hafnium we find today and how much lutetium was in there. And so you can, knowing how it decayed, you can get the age information from that.
Are you in any danger when you're dealing with these rocks that have, you know, magnetism and radiation?
No, because we're talking about really, really low levels of concentration, so that's not harmful. And especially also because these elements decay very slowly, so you don't get exposed to, you know, any danger.
So, Dr. Gitro, where do you see yourself headed, you know, with your studies, with this postdoctoral fellowship, and with what you've told us today? What are you hoping to do with this work?
Well, I hope I'm going to be able to get a career in academia, because I really like to teach and also to do this kind of research and get new knowledge about how the Earth evolved, because it's just, you know, a small brick to build the bigger wall, which is, you know, understanding the evolution of the solar system, development of life, evolution of planets, to be able to better understand the world we live in, actually.
Do you think it's important that we have the scientific community able to explain some of these more complex things that they're finding out in clear terms for the general public, so that if you follow this, you're educating young minds, they're going to come in, do your experiments? Is there any value to saying it's nice for all of us scientists to understand what we're doing, but we need to be able to make this understandable to the general population? So that if something needs to be done, whether it be politically, environmentally, whatever it is, people will have the information and understand it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I mean, that's part of our service, is to explain what we do to the general people so that they know, and not necessarily to the general people, but also to politicians, because sometimes, you know, they have to make decisions based on scientific matter. And if they don't understand what's going on, you know, they need to have somebody to tell them. And I guess that's part of our job as well.
It's been a fascinating discussion. We've been talking with Dr. Martin Gitro. He is a postdoctoral research teaching associate working at the University of New Hampshire. He's been studying geochemistry, igneous and metamorphic petrology. He's been telling us about the Earth, the Earth's crust, the rocks, how they're formed, and a little bit into what his interests are and where he's headed. And Dr. Gitro, I can't tell you how much we appreciate having you on the program today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Dr. Martin Gitro is a postdoctoral research teaching associate at the University of New Hampshire. He spoke to the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gastina about his work as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. To learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series, go to origins.rpi.edu. There used to be a rock bridge between Asia and North America across what is now the Bering Strait. Recently, there have been studies suggesting that there were people indigenous to that region and what their life may have been like. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. The Bering Strait is famously referred to as the path that early settlers of North America took to get here. But as the University of Utah's professor of anthropology, Dennis O'Rourke, suggests, our ancestral roots in this area might go much further.
During the last glacial maximum, thick ice sheets in Europe and North America dropped sea levels some 400 feet, exposing a broad undersea shelf connecting Siberia and Alaska. Known as the Bering Land Bridge, it measured 1,000 miles north to south and 3,000 miles east to west. Genetic evidence indicates the ancestors of Native Americans lived in the region for 10,000 years until they began moving south about 15,000 years ago. But the presence of a resident Beringian population has been questioned since there is little archaeological evidence to support it. My colleagues, John Hoffaker, Scott Elias, and I seek to reconcile existing genetic evidence for human habitation on the land bridge with paleoecological data and an absence of archaeological evidence. Unlike much of northern North America, Beringia lacked lowland glaciers, and the land bridge at its center experienced summer temperatures little different from today. Sediment cores drilled from the Bering seafloor contain plant and insect fossils, indicating the land bridge was dotted by refugia of dwarf shrubs and possibly even trees. Wood resources would have been critical for survival and subsistence on the land bridge. A distinct Native American genome had emerged by 25,000 years ago. A key element in its development was extended isolation from its Asian source. The shrub tundra refugia on the land bridge provided perhaps the only geographic area at high latitudes where a population could survive the last glacial maximum in total isolation. Populations inhabiting these refugia would be nearly invisible archaeologically, since the refugia are now submerged under the Bering and Chukchi Seas. Evidence of human habitation in Pleistocene shrub tundra might still remain in low-lying portions of Alaska and eastern Siberia.
That was Dennis O'Rourke of the University of Utah. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.